women started to hemorrhage to death following childbirth. These are not old people dying who have health issues. These are people in the prime of their lives. If two 747 planes fell out of the sky every single day, nobody would fly. People would be asking some questions, but that number of women die every day. And those women are women of color often, or women who are marginalized for some reason, they're malnourished, you know? And when we change the staple food of such a large population of the world, we really endanger women. And what happens to a family when a young woman dies having a baby?
I still see your eyes. My God.
Hi, I'm Steve, and I'm here with my uber-talented and extremely inquisitive daughter, Erin.
Hey, everybody.
And this is Better Place Project with Steve Norris.
Make the world a better place. Make the world a better place. Make the world a better place. Make the world a better place.
How we doing, Erin?
I'm pretty good. This whole year, I've been feeling kind of off because of COVID and, you know, the quarantine and the lockdowns and everything. It's just been a weird year, and I'm still mentally stuck in March.
Yeah, a weird year indeed it has been. And what's crazy is that one day I'll catch myself saying, oh my gosh, we're at the holidays already. Where did the time go? And then the next day, it just seems like we're going at a snail's pace, and this whole pandemic has just slowed everything down. So how it can possibly be that it seems like it's flying by and going at a snail's pace, I'm still trying to wrap my brain around that. But crazy times,
yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah, and it's also kind of... really, I don't know. It's also kind of strange because I don't really have any events going on or things to look forward to for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And normally that's how I kind of gauge how the time is going and everything like that.
Well, and especially this time of year, usually during the holidays, we have office parties, we've got our friends' parties, and so many things we're going to, and we're so busy. And there's none of that this year, which
yeah.
makes it very, very strange. So, we hope mm-hmm. all of you out there are staying safe, and happy holidays to everybody.
Yes, and I'm excited for the holidays. I'm officially in the holiday spirit, and
you're always
at least
in
we
the
have
holiday
that to
spirit.
Look forward to.
You start playing Christmas music your entire childhood. You wanted Christmas music around Halloween time, which drove me crazy.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Yes.
I'm not the only one, I'm sure.
There's everything wrong with that. No Christmas music till the day after Thanksgiving. Those are the rules, Erin.
I disagree.
Anyway, the good news is, wow, what an incredible show we have for you guys today to have the 2011 CNN Hero of the Year, Robin Lim. But before we get to that, we've got a couple shout-outs for you. The first is a really cool company called E&S Grounding Solutions. They offer grounding, earthing, and bonding solutions for electrical systems. No, you parents at home, these aren't grounding solutions for how to ground your kids. I had to ground Erin constantly throughout her childhood. Actually, that's not true
no
at
way.
All. She was the sweetest little thing that never, ever was grounded, but her two brothers, they were constantly in the doghouse.
I was grounded a little bit.
Really? For what? I don't remember ever grounding
Not
you.
Not cleaning my room, for sure.
Well, that's true. We may have said, you can't come out of your room until it's clean, and so you spent the next 3 weeks in your room. That is true. I do remember that.
Pretty much.
You would sit there and I would pop back into your room like 2 hours later. Erin, it'll only take you 5 minutes to clean up. Why don't you just hurry and clean it? Then you can go play with your friends. Okay. Then an hour later, I come back and you're still sitting there playing on the floor.
I had better things to do.
I guess. Anyway, back to the electrical grounding solutions. ENS Grounding Solutions, they make people safe that are working in high voltage environments. Their mission is, we engineer, educate, and empower the world's leading electrical engineers and companies to become safer, more successful, and more profitable every single day. You can find them at esgrounding.com. That's Edward Sam, esgrounding.com. And another shout out to our friend Nourished by Julie. Julie is out of Australia. She offers these amazing interactive online cooking classes via Zoom, where each week she sends you a list of ingredients to get at the grocery store, how to prep all the food, what to do ahead of time, and then you and all the other students from around the world cook together online. You can ask her questions. You can watch the video of how she's doing everything. You can find Julie at nourishedbyjulie.com.au. Don't forget the AU. Once again, nourishedbyjulie.com.au, because she is in Australia. And all over social media, Instagram, Facebook, and whatnot at Nourished by Julie. Okay, on to the fun stuff. We have the 2011 CNN Hero of the Year. Ibu Robin Lim is with us today. Erin, tell us a little bit about our guest.
Ibu Robin Lim is a midwife, mother, grandmother, and founder of Bumi Sehat, a nonprofit organization in Indonesia. Lim also serves on the board of Bumi Wada Philippines, where she is known as Lola Robin. Her passion is human rights and childbirth. She believes that each individual is an essential piece of peace. Therefore, by protecting the mothers in childbirth and the newborns, our smallest citizens of Earth, we may build peace, one baby, one mother, one family at a time. You can learn more about her and what she's doing at iburobin.com. That's iburobin.com.
This conversation took everything I thought I knew about childbirth, especially in other parts of the world, and completely turned that all upside down. And Robin just exudes joy and love as she continues to so passionately fight for this cause that she believes in.
Yeah, she is incredible. She is super kind, and you can tell she has a lot of compassion. And just talking to her, she has such a warm presence.
And you hear her talk about all the stories and what she's doing, and it's so inspirational. But at the same time, I'm like, what am I doing with my life? She's just dedicating her life to this amazing cause of saving women around the world and reducing mortality of women giving birth and their children is incredible. We do want to point out, you guys, that the audio, we did have challenges. She is lives in Indonesia, in Bali, and that's where we recorded our call with her. And so in the background, you're going to hear chainsaws and gardeners sweeping, and she even takes a phone call from her daughter during the call, which we loved. We kept it in the podcast because I think that shows Robin's priorities, no matter what, her family, the people around her. And while I was doing some research on her, I came across a video with a song that her husband had written for her. And it's such a beautiful, touching song that I thought, in fact, I told Robin that we have to incorporate that into the podcast. So we have some bonus material for you guys at the end of this podcast. Stick around and you will hear the song in its entirety, along with also some of Robin's inspirational thoughts that she throws out here throughout this conversation that you're about to hear. So stick around for that. But in the meantime, here is Robin Lim. And here is a teaser of the song written by her husband, Will Hammer.
Thank you.
rock lay all around us.
Good morning, Ibu Robin. How are you?
Selamat pagi. I'm great.
Thank you so much for joining us. I know it's early in the morning. I think it's, what, about 7:30 a.m. there. We are absolutely thrilled to have you as a guest on this podcast. In fact, I was checking a couple days ago, and I did a quick check, and I realized you also are officially the farthest person away from us. You are approximately 8,615 miles away from me here in Los Angeles. I'm in L.A. Aaron's down in Orange County, but we're both here in Southern California. So thank you so much for being here. Let's dive right in. What can you kind of go back to the very beginning, that how did you end up being a midwife from the get-go?
Ooh, probably I became a teenage mom, and I was a teenage mom in Santa Barbara, California, while I was attending Santa Barbara City College. And I was really blessed to not have insurance. And so I found a pair of young midwives who are now, you know, just senior, amazing midwives. And they agreed to come to my little trailer house where we had this beautiful little baby girl. She's 44 now. My daughter's my best friend. She's my guru. She's, there was a true awakening to have a beautiful baby come into your arms and into your life, and also to have it happen serendipitously, so gently, with so much respect for me and for my baby. And I mean, the whole piece of human rights in childbirth was just handed to me, and I was a kid. And so I thought it was like that for everyone. And I found out it wasn't. And it was a slow process of, you know, going to school with my baby strapped to my little backpack and riding my bike, or my front pack, and riding my bicycle with her. She always says she went to college twice, because she went with me and then she went again. She's done an incredible film called Guerrilla Midwife that I'm not sure how we can get you a copy. I can try to figure out how to get you a copy. But we've used it as a fundraising tool over the years. It's really
I would love to see it. Yeah, maybe on a Dropbox or something that we could go out and do.
That's a good idea. She's won awards. She's quite an extraordinary filmmaker. It happened kind of by accident. And then in 1990, it was 30 years ago today, my younger sister died from a complication of her third pregnancy.
That was 30 years ago today.
30 years ago. And last night I was reflecting on that, and I said, it must have been 20 years. And no, it was 30 years. And so she was 32 years old. She'd be a grandmother now. My nephews were left without their mom. It was devastating for our family. I talked to her the day before, and she wasn't feeling well. And she was living in Alabama where her husband was working, and she was facing a lot of racism. I mean, we're mixed race children. My mother's Asian, Filipino Pacific Islander. And my father is, you know, he was a tall, very white, redheaded guy. And her husband was Korean. And so people in Alabama would slam into her little boys with their grocery carts and say, you people should just go home. And she had insurance, and she was in the care of an OBGYN. And she, you know, when she called me, I said, you've got to, you know, see somebody right away. It was evening then when she called me, and she said, yeah, I have an appointment in the morning. I'm going in to see the doctor. Don't worry. And she went in, and, you know, he was very brisk. He did not look at the fact that she had hypertension. The nurse that took her blood pressure before she came into the exam room did not inform him that she had extreme hypertension. And she wanted to talk to him about how badly she felt. She was having blurry vision. She was feeling like her face was swollen, her feet were swollen, her hands were swollen. So she had all the signs of preeclampsia. And this was a preventable death. And he was just too busy And I know as a primary health care provider for pregnant women and birthing women and postpartum women and their babies and their families, I know that it, you can get incredibly busy, but mm-hmm. it's required that we pay attention. And she fell through the cracks, and he, you know, probably just didn't think about her as a real human being. I mean, she's sitting
there.
That
was right here in the United States, correct?
In Alabama, which is one of the worst places to have a baby on earth, I might point out statistically.
Really?
I don't know if you know that since 1986, the United States has had a steeply rising maternal mortality rate.
I did not know
that. Christy Turlington Burns from Every Mother Counts has been addressing that.
We wanted to talk to her today about that as
well. Oh, yeah. She's such a valiant. She's one of my heroes. I mm-hmm. love Christy. And her organization has helped us tremendously.
That was one of my questions. Great. Please,
absolutely.
Yeah, tell us about that. I can imagine. Well, having a supermodel, you know, in fact, introduce you at the CNN Awards. I mean, that's pretty, pretty cool. And then having her shine a light on your organization. Tell us about what impact that had on your work.
Oh, absolutely. A huge impact. I mean, she's been a friend. I'm super busy, so I don't talk to her all the time. But if I have a problem, I do email her. Jessica from her organization went to the Rohingya camp with myself and Ibu Budi last year to help Hope Foundation instill some really beautiful, more humanistic, loving, gentle protocols, even in the refugee camps. And mm-hmm. it's pretty terrible there. And then they helped right away after that serendipitous meeting. We heard we were both invited to go to the Rohingya camp with Hope Foundation, and Christy sent Jessica, and we spent so much time together during that time, and mm-hmm. then right away they were able to send money to help finish the building of our Papuan. We have in Sentani, Papua, we have a Bumi Sehat. So we have 4 in Indonesia and 2 in the Philippines.
Okay, so you have 6 total now. Bumi Sehat centers. Okay.
Yes, I'd like to keep it at 6, at least for a while.
And for our...
Until somebody like gives me a huge endowment, because I tell you, my day and night thing is to constantly raise money. I'm constantly, you know... Well,
hopefully we can be a part of helping shed light on your organization.
The most profound way that Christy helped us was in 2012. I was walking to the clinic and my handphone blew up and started ringing, and I answered it. And I know when the handphone starts ringing and it's Bumi Sehat, it's the clinic, that I need to run, because they will call me to emergency.
Somebody
was in trouble, and it was one of the younger midwives, and, you know, breathlessly telling me that, you know, a mother has arrived and there's a baby's foot hanging out of her.
Right.
And that, you know,
come please,
they need extra help, just because that's one of those things where you want all hands on deck. You want your most experienced midwives. And so I arrived there quickly, and we had a very nice delivery of a breech baby boy. And he made no attempt to breathe. And so we started resuscitating him. He had a very narrow face. So the bag and mask didn't work. And the team is like a machine. When we have an emergency, you know, immediately the preemie bag and mask came over my shoulder and we started using that. It didn't work, you know. So I wiped his face and I did mouth to mouth on him, because I'm not going to let a baby die.
Sure. Yeah.
Which is foolish when you don't know someone's HIV status.
Sure.
And it turned out that that the mother's viral load was off the scale. And so I had deep exposure. We resuscitated him for a good 40 minutes, and he kept hanging in there. And then he let out a lusty cry, and he was great. And he went right to his mother's.
Wow.
Oh, yes. Except that, you know, we hadn't really looked at this mother. It had happened so quickly. Mm-hmm. And when we put him skin to skin with her, of course, you know, while myself and another midwife were resuscitating the baby and taking care of him, other midwives were taking care of the mother, laying her down, making sure she was comfortable. But she had almost no emotional reaction to her baby at all. And then we noticed that she had condyloma, which is warts from her ears to her knees. And you don't get that unless you're immunocompromised. Mm-hmm. And so we asked her, and the baby went right to the breast, and she was, you know, with him, but not with him, not all there. And I said, can we draw some of your blood? And at that time, we had to send it to a lab, and we had to pay almost $200, you know, out of pocket.
Sure.
I mean, this mother had nothing, and we wouldn't ask her. I mean, she was in extreme strife. And anyway, she agreed. She said, fine. She said, I don't care. And 3 or 4 hours later, we had the results that she had a very high viral load, and she had AIDS.
Right.
And I had resuscitated her baby. So I went on antiretrovirals, and as did, there were three of us who were had extreme deep exposure.
Now,
we're
can
all
I ask
fine.
A question about that? After mm-hmm. you heard that, did you have any regrets? Now you've been exposed to HIV and you know it. Did you were thinking, oh my gosh, why did I do that? Now I could possibly have HIV.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was so concerned about the baby, and I yeah. would not have changed that.
Sure.
I mean, that mother, you know, bless her, she got to spend that time with her baby. I walked home very slowly after, you know, we had a little meeting with those of us that were at the birth, and we determined who really, you know, had the most exposure. And we called the government agency that does the antiretroviral distribution, and we made an appointment for the morning to go in right away. And we did need to transport the baby to an AIDS unit because he would go in and out, and they really tried to keep him alive. He lived 36 more hours, and but that mother had a few hours with her son. Wow. And we got her on antiretrovirals, but I walked home slowly, and I didn't know what to say to my family. You know, that was for them, that was traumatic for them. I think more traumatic for them than for me.
I bet.
And I just didn't say anything. And I went upstairs and I sat at this computer, this little old computer. And I said, okay, what do I do with this information? You know, with this event in my life. And I wrote an email to Christy. And
wow.
She shot back an email in must have been the middle of the night her time, saying, okay, first of all, you know, I am so sorry this is happening in your life, but what you really need is a lab. I said, yeah, we need our own lab. And she said, we'll figure it out. And she raised $52,000, because opening a lab is no easy,
wow.
even in Indonesia. I mean, the equipment is hideously expensive. I mean, the reagents, you have to air condition it. Everything has to be temperature controlled. You know, you have to hire lab technicians. You have to make sure their training is excellent. And anyway, she made it happen just like that. And,
oh, wow. And
so
I understand,
for me,
I'm sorry. I was going to say, I understand Christy for this, Christy Turlington, this is very, very dear to her heart as well, because I read that she had pretty serious complications in her own childbirth, which made
yes.
her realize how lucky she is to have had top medical care, and but also realize that she wanted to be involved in helping people around the world same way as you are. So
yeah, she wouldn't be with us today if she didn't have excellent medical care at the time that she gave birth to her baby. She had a serious postpartum complication, so she knows firsthand what it is to
sure.
be slipping away when what you really want to do is be there for your baby.
Right.
So, and mothers slip away all the time, as did my sister. But because of her, we have a lab. We have and it's called the Bumi Valentino, because the baby's name was Valentino. He was born on Valentine's
nice.
Day.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I want to throw
his
out.
His mother lived 7 more years. She was
really.
She was on the antiretrovirals, and she stayed on our radar. Unfortunately, she went back to Sumba, where she's originally from, and being in Sumba, you cannot get antiretrovirals. And she changed hand phone numbers or lost her hand phone, and we lost track of her.
Wow.
So we tried, but she did through her family. We did. Find out that she had moved to the interior, the poorest part of Sumba, where they have rainy season and they have hungry season.
Oh, geez.
And yeah, they have two seasons. And she lived 7 more years, almost exactly. I think it was a few days before Valentino's would have been his 7th birthday that she passed.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we have not only do we have a lab, but we have a fabulous HIV counselor who holds everyone's hand through the process. He himself is HIV positive. So he's had an incredible quality of life. So wow, he knows good. How to keep people healthy and how to keep them from feeling stigmatized. It's a tough thing to have happen to you to show up HIV positive. I feel blessed every day that that one passed over and that we're all fine. All the midwives involved good. Are fine.
Good. Yeah, yeah. I think in our, you know, here in America, I think with Magic Johnson getting it back in the 90s, I think that's done a lot for making it not such a stigma. And the fact that exactly. he lives this healthy life and it's not a death sentence anymore. So
exactly.
don't get me wrong. Nobody wants it. You certainly didn't want it. And you dodged a bullet. Thankfully, you clearly put the lives of the baby in ahead of your own. And that's just such an incredible, noble thing to do. You saved a life first and asked questions later. Thankfully, you came out okay. So I'm sorry to hear that about the mother, though. What a tragic story.
Mm-hmm. She was a wonderful person, too.
That's really sad. Robin, that's actually a question that I had for you. Can you talk about the reason why the infant and maternal mortality rates are so high in Indonesia?
Mm. Well, Indonesia is a country that's, changing and growing quickly. Population-wise, we're the fourth largest country in the world. We're an island nation, so, things are spread out over a very long, wide archipelago. And so access, for example, I'm very good friends with midwives on the island of Flores, which is, a couple hours flight. It actually probably takes me longer to drive to the airport than to fly there. Nice. But, they have one major hospital in Ruteng, which is in the center of the island up on the mountain. It's a 4 to 5 hour transport on bad roads and in the rainy season, Jeez. Nearly impossible to get from, for example, Labuan Bajo, which is a major population center. They have a government clinic there, but if someone has a hemorrhage, which is hemorrhage after childbirth is the leading cause of death here in Bali, and it's generally across the world one of the things that really takes mothers out. So what drives mm-hmm. that hemorrhage after childbirth? It doesn't happen randomly. It's nutrition. So, you can say, well, why don't the mothers eat better when they're pregnant? But what happened politically is that in the 70s, the rice got changed throughout Asia. And mm-hmm. it's called Green Revolution rice. They shouldn't call it Green Revolution. It's like a doublespeak. And it was a rice that was not genetically engineered, but hybrid, so that you get three crops a year. It's a fast-growing, high-yield rice. Mm-hmm. And they have to pollinate it because they spray it. They spray it with, and it's necessary to spray it or it won't survive. Fungicides, herbicides, mm-hmm. pesticides. This sort of chemicalized poisonous farming so the red rice that all the people ate here, the indigenous rice of Bali, became nearly extinct. There are many farmers who save their seeds and who now, my family eats red rice and we eat brown rice. But my kids love white rice. I have to tell you, they grew up here. And at first people were so depressed, but within the second season of the government mandate to grow the new rice, the high yield rice, within the second season, women started to hemorrhage to death following childbirth. These are not old people dying who have health issues. These are people in the prime of their lives. Mm-hmm. Now, worldwide, it's down a little bit to about 830 per day.
In fact, that was a question that I had for you, because I remember on your TED Talk from a few years ago, at that time anyway, it was like 950 or 970, 970 women dying every day.
It, it was 900 and I think it was 998. It was okay. Like two 747s falling out of the sky. It was the equivalent of that. If two 747 planes fell out of the sky every single day, nobody would fly.
People would be freaking out.
So, and people would be asking some questions, exactly. But that number of women die mm-hmm. every day. And those women are women of color often, mm-hmm. or women who are marginalized. For some reason, they're malnourished. You know, and when we change the staple food of such a large population of the world, we really endangered women.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And what happens to a family when a young woman dies having a baby? I mean, in Indonesia, most women are having two children. There's a whole government push that's called Dua Anak Cukup, two children enough. Because people had huge families and the population was really, really high. You know, the rate was growing and growing. And in order to help to control poverty, the government, you know, really pushed family planning. I would say birth control more than family planning, because family planning is when the mother feels like she's in control and has a choice. But when the powers that be are more in control and they're marching you in to get injections that are harming your health, but that are controlling the population. You know, those are all controversial issues.
Yeah.
And however, Indonesia has really, really controlled their population. And there have been benefits to that for the families to have. Yeah. And which means that both children get to go to school. Because even, you know, going to school costs money. Even the government schools, you have to buy your children's books. You have to pay the little tiny bit of tuition. And that's a lot for a family that's living off of, say, a family of
$8
of many
a day,
generations.
I think that's pretty low.
Yeah. It's low. Well, and that's someone who's working full time, 6 day weeks. Mm-hmm. When I first came here, everybody was working 7 day weeks. Mm-hmm. And most families had one person, one wage earner. The average in Indonesia when I first came in the 90s, one wage earner was carrying 17 people.
Wow.
You know, because we have multi-generation, and that's part of the beauty. I mean, even in this time of COVID, we have multi-generations at home. So people are worried that if they go to work, that they will bring COVID home to their grandparents. Grandparents are not sitting around in rocking chairs here. They're raising the grandchildren and the great grandchildren.
Wow.
And they're very active. They're in the fields working in the farms and they take the children with them. This is how the young couples are able to get education, because their grandparents are taking care of their children.
Wow.
So everyone really cares about their elders here and we don't want to lose them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an issue, but we really have to think about changing the staple food of entire countries and how, you know, it was something that was well-intended and it was a disaster. And anyway, we can go back to whoever thought of spraying poison all over
Seriously.
The food of human beings.
Yeah.
You know,
so
I mean, I know people that buy organic food for their dogs.
Yeah. Oh, and here in California, it's very
There's
prevalent.
There's a lot of that here.
If you want to buy stock in Wall Street, buy pet food, buy, you know, PetSmart and companies that sell, you know, products for pets. You're right. So.
Mm-hmm. And you cannot tell a pregnant woman who's, you know, basically barely living that she needs to eat more healthy foods. You know, I mean, there are things here like sweet potatoes are very, very inexpensive and nobody sprays their sweet potatoes.
And I love them. They're so good.
Aren't they great? And they're medicine for the uterus, by the way. You should remember that, Erin. You're a woman.
Good to know.
Yeah. And I love sweet potatoes. Anyway, sweet potatoes, we always tell the mothers. But we also do things like if we get any kind of money ahead, we buy a truckload of sweet potatoes. They're also antiviral. So we're feeding a lot of families right now.
Yep.
Bali's facing 80% unemployment at this time.
80? 8-0. Wow.
8-0 plus.
Wow.
With the complete loss of tourism. You know, think about it. The farmer that used to sell a truckload of oranges three times a week to the hotels.
Sure.
Those oranges are rotting.
That's
nothing. Nothing.
So you've got situations where there's, malnourished or eating, pesticide-laden food. You've got unemployment. And the other thing that really, as I'm preparing for this chat with you over the last few days, and the more I read, the more it just really, I just kind of wanted to shout to the world of what's going on over there in other parts of the world, in that here we live in a bubble here in America. Nobody's worried about, for the most part, except it sounds like maybe in Alabama, like you were saying, but for the most part, you go to your Lamaze classes, you prep for it, you break your water, you hop in your Honda Civic, and you drive to the hospital, and you deliver your baby with excellent health care. And we just take that for granted here. And to hear, when I was watching one of your interviews from a few years ago, you said that that most of the mothers that arrive there, obviously they're 9 months pregnant, they're coming by boat, then they get on a motorcycle and they ride on a motorcycle in the rain to get to your clinic. And I can't even imagine going through that 9 months pregnant on the back of a motorcycle, probably in severe pain to have your baby. And I love what you said. You said they come on a motorcycle in the rain at night, but then when they arrive, they get a hug. And I love that. Mm. So
it's true.
So
it's true.
What is the typical, how far does the typical person, woman, and in some cases her husband, I saw some great videos with the couples talking together about their experience at one of your clinics, which, by the way, I want to throw this out before I forget. It's bumisehat.org. That's B-U, B as in boy, U-M-I-S-E-H-A-T. bumisehat.org, and we'll also put it in the notes of the podcast. But So how far does the typical woman, and with her, husband or what have you, or alone, does she have to travel on average to get to one of your clinics?
It really depends. I mean, we have mothers that walk just down the road from our village here. And, they come with their mother. They come with their mother-in-law. They come with their husband.
They're the lucky ones.
They come with their other. Their children, or we have a playground,
yeah.
There, and it went from being this hugely busy community center where it was just buzzing with people, because we have acupuncturists there, we have doctors, we have nurses, so we have community health on one end, and then on the other end we have the childbirth wing, and then the recovery wing, where the each family, no matter how poor you are, you get a private room with your own bathroom. It's really a thrill,
and it's free.
Then we have people. It's free.
It's
we of course accept donations. We are struggling. COVID took one of our biggest donors at the end of May. Beautiful Japanese human rights attorney.
You're kidding.
And one of my best friends, Toru was married to Kazumi, who's one of my best friends on earth. And she recovered. He did not. And
wow.
So, that was hard. You ask how far people travel. We had, for example, many years ago, a mother showed up from Papua. Ah. And she was huge pregnant. I don't know how she managed to get an airline ticket. She was with her husband. They had saved money to come. And she had a little boy. And she told the story of waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting before going to the hospital in Papua. Because Papua is way, way, way on the eastern end of Indonesia. And she said she knew that they were giving everyone cesareans, whether they needed them or not.
Jeez.
Now, don't get me wrong. I think that belly birth is an incredible miracle. It's a birth. If you need a belly birth and it saves your life or your baby's life or both of you, I'm all about it. Better living through science.
Of course.
But Rachel had come into the hospital. And she said she felt like she was going to push. They told her she was 8 centimeters. But many of the medical schools, they need to practice on people. So who do you practice on? You go out to way to the eastern part of Indonesia, where the Australasians live, the black people.
Jeez.
Because black lives don't matter. It's really sad. And, here she is with her beautiful hair and her dark skin. And she walked into the hospital. And they held her down and knocked her out and cut her. And so she did not want to have that happen to her next. And she was separated from her child for several days. You know, she had complications. She almost lost her life. And she and her husband were determined not to let that happen. So they came all the way from the other side of Indonesia, from the east, the furthest eastern frontier in Sentani, Papua. She had a beautiful vaginal birth after cesarean. When her third baby was born, was ready to be born, she showed up again. In fact, you know, they stayed in my home because once they got here, it was like how, they didn't have money to stay in some kind of an accommodation.
Right.
And then her father, who's a Christian pastor, and her uncle Marcos, they got together and they talked to the church and they had a piece of land. And they literally said, look, we have this land. We will sign it over to Bumi Sehat as our commitment because we know how difficult it is for Bumi Sehat to have such a remote, faraway clinic. But will you do that for us? So what am I going to say? You know, there's such a need there. And I went to Sentani a couple of times and I saw the need and I talked to the midwives. I talked to them about their challenges. And so I did... I said, sure. And then a beautiful widower from Japan, whose wife's dying wish was that the money that she was leaving behind her would go to helping mothers and babies. She herself was not able to be a mother, although she wanted to be. And she died when she was 40. And so we have the Angel Hiromi Bumi Sehat Childbirth Center in Sentani, Papua. And all because Raquel decided that, you know what? The human rights of myself and my baby are really important. I'm going to find my way to this birth center that I heard a rumor was going to be kind and loving, and I would have skilled midwives, and I would be respected. Mm-hmm. Respectful care is something that everyone needs, and so now she's the executive director there.
Oh, wow.
We opened. Yeah, it was great. We finally did open last Christmas with the Christmas morning baby. Sadly, one of our senior midwives there, Farida, she passed away from COVID.
COVID. Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm.
Yes. COVID is a big problem all over. It's not as bad in Indonesia, for example, as the US. We're not nearly as, critical, but Papua has a big problem. And one of the pastors that assigned the land to us, Pastor Marcos, died about a week ago. Also of COVID. So it's four of our midwives caught it. We were able to get three of them through. We feel blessed, but Farida left three daughters, high school, middle school, and elementary school age, and a devastated husband. We're quite in shock and mourning about losing two of our beloved people in Papua. We hope that this is going to slow down. We really do.
Yeah.
So sorry,
but they're doing a tremendous job. I got a picture this morning on my phone of a new baby born in the center.
Nice.
And it's just every day. They're teaching childbirth classes. They're, they have to limit it to nine student mothers and the teacher because it's 10. Mm-hmm. Here in this country, and they do social distancing, but it's a beautiful thing. So sometimes out of tragedy, I mean, a terrible experience for one mother, she turned it into a beautiful thing.
Yeah,
for her people.
A positive. What a great mm-hmm. story,
and a service to her community.
And speaking of C-sections, you talk about that a little bit, that technology being sold to us in one of your talks. I think it was an Italian doctor that in one of your videos pointed out that in non-human mammals, if you disturb the birth process, the mother does not care about the baby. So I'm not saying that happens obviously with humans, but I think one can't deny that especially if it's an unnecessary C-section, you're robbing the mother and the baby of that bond, are you not? Of that bond of immediately after the child is born.
Yeah, we call it first embrace. In the Philippines, it's called unang yakap. And there's a national incentive to protect the first embrace between mother and child. That only happens once in a lifetime. And my daughter, for example, in 2016, living in Santa Rosa, California, planning a beautiful natural childbirth at the Thrive Birth Center with our friends, and I was there. And there have been a lot of complications because of the climate crisis-driven fires there in California. And we're going to see more and more health crises along with the climate crisis. But what I've been told by the maternity nurses, the midwives, and the OBs there in Santa Rosa is that since the fires started to cause, so, you know, at one point they lost so many homes and, you know, and businesses. And for example, every nurse I talked to had either lost her home or had a family member that lost their home. So it was it's a pretty critical situation there. As yeah. you know, you're there in California.
Absolutely. It's been a nightmare.
The air quality, but the effect it's having on pregnancy was that they've had so many emergencies with the placenta, and my daughter having a beautiful labor, 7 centimeters, and her placenta started to abrupt, which means come loose from the uterine wall, which is an almost unheard of complication.
Really?
And
wow.
And we made a snap decision. It can, because it can be, it's quickly fatal for the baby and can be for the mother. So we moved to the hospital, and we were blessed to have a beautiful belly birth. And I was there along with my daughter's husband, and we were able to get the baby immediately, skin to skin with my daughter. You know, the pediatric nurse was not happy about that because she felt that the baby needed to be weighed and measured. Guess what?
Jeez.
I've never met a baby. I'm probably
Tell me how much I weigh, please. I need to know. Wow.
Brand new into the world saying, how much do I weigh? That's more important. No, and my daughter had an incredible bond with her son. And I just returned from the U.S. because I found my way out there. My daughter and her husband were planning to move back to Bali and be here with our family because they felt like to have a vaginal birth after cesarean, they really wanted to be here. Even though, you know, the medical care in the U.S. can be so beautiful, the hospital's so clean and shiny, and they felt like their chances of having a vaginal birth after a belly birth with the first baby were much better. But COVID hit, and my daughter's a doctor of traditional Chinese medicine, and her PhD is in reproductive health, and so she didn't want to just dump her jobs. She's doing community health acupuncture, and also working with a private group doing fertility for helping mothers who are getting IVF, doing acupuncture before the procedure and then right after, and with 100% success, by the way. So my daughter didn't just want to leave. She had given 3 months notice, but then she started to realize, wow, this pandemic thing is really happening. And so by the time they were ready to go, it was too late. They couldn't travel to Bali. So I was able to get somehow there. And we went together to Texas, to Austin, to her sister's home. And we had a beautiful, long, hard labor, but we had a beautiful vaginal birth after her cesarean with the first one. But I want to say to mothers out there who've had belly births, remember it was a birth.
Sure.
Even if you felt like you needed that, even if whatever happened, you know, you had a birth. Your baby was born. This is a miracle. And I feel like so many mothers are walking around feeling like they somehow failed because they didn't have the natural childbirth that they had wanted,
sure,
or that they thought they should have. I want those mothers to really understand how heroic they are and how much I admire them, because they went the distance for whatever reason. They went the distance for their baby. And that is a huge thing, to have a major abdominal surgery to bring your baby safely earthside.
Yep.
So I want to say thank you to those mothers.
The end result is still a beautiful baby. So,
and the great thing about human being is beings, didn't Elizabeth Kubler-Ross say human beings are 100% repairable?
Yeah.
I mean, our traumas, we somehow, as Michelle Odon, the French obstetrician said that, you know, full stop, when a mammal outside of the human race, when a mammal has a cesarean birth, they do not bond to their baby. Whereas people are so resilient, and that their love prevails. Our love prevails. And so for those mothers, I know it's not easy. I know my daughter's breastfeeding challenges with that first baby were, you know, quite profound. And yet she overcame all of it. And now she has a beautiful brand new baby girl. And my grandson Bear is the most tender big brother. He's just brilliant. And all the things you worry about with a baby who's not born vaginally, he's been incredible and healthy and brilliant.
After research, by the way, I'm picking up in your audio the sound of like a sweeping or a raking. Is there like a gardener in the background, or is that what it is?
We're in Bali. We're in Bali. Someone is sweeping. You're going to hear chickens. I can hear a chainsaw in the distance. Somebody's trimming a tree.
Okay. All right. It's getting a little quieter. I think it's okay. So
yeah.
Just when I thought I had learned literally everything about you and everything I can about what's going on and what you're doing with your clinic, I came across a talk that you spoke of delayed clamping and cutting of the umbilical cord and what effect and the importance of that and the blood loss to the baby. I was completely oblivious to that. And it makes so much sense when you explained it. So for our listeners here, you know, in America that normally our baby's born, they put the baby, hey, congratulations. And then the husband or the boyfriend sometimes gets to, you know, cut the cord. And so can you talk a little bit about why we don't want to do that? Why you recommend we don't do that immediately?
Yes. So no other species of mammal interferes with the bonding between mother and child. No other species of mammal pulls on the placenta to get it out. No other species cuts the cord. And I don't know why it became considered like some kind of a rescue operation. Get the baby as far as you can from the vagina and cut the connection.
He's been perfectly fine there, or she, for 9 months. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, my goodness, the mother is not the evil, dark place. And what I discovered in my research, first of all, here in Bali, there are holy books written on slats of bamboo. There were pre-ball pen, scratch with a kris knife, and then with ash rubbed against them, so you can read the Sanskrit writing.
Yeah.
And it says there that you should not disturb the umbilical cord.
Really?
So this is, you know, I mean, the Lontars that I've looked at were 9 generations old. They were made 9 generations before. And so that was 20 some years ago when I looked at those Lontars. And I was questioning, why are they clamping and cutting the cord immediately? Of course, as a teenager, I had my first baby at home. Then I had all my babies at home. And, you know, sometime after the placenta was born, someone started looking for, should we do something about the cord? You know, hours later, my babies are fine. They're brilliant. So why is it that it became such a quick thing? Hospital efficiency, for one.
Jeez.
Got to get your OB back to his golf game.
Seriously.
And pediatricians started saying, why? Massimo Alozzi, who's a pediatrician in Italy, is just on fire with this. He goes hospital to hospital saying, you have to stop this. But remember,
and he visited your
they
clinic,
started
did
harvest.
He not?
Oh, that was Niccolo.
Oh, Niccolo. Okay.
He's
that's
an OBGYN.
Right. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, our midwives in the Philippines, when they feel sad and lonely, they watch that video because they just love Niccolo. They don't understand what the heck he's saying in Italian. And I said, why are you watching this video again and again? And they go, he's so cute.
The handsome
he's like
Italian
my son's
doctor.
Age.
Yeah. That's funny.
He's a beautiful guy. And he and Massimo work very hard as an OBGYN and a pediatrician to advocate. Because remember, Italy and the United States and all over the world, this thing of harvesting the stem cells and using those stem cells, that blood supply belongs to the baby. And if you immediately clamp and cut, you're leaving 60% sometimes or, or even more, behind. And remember, the cord is pulsing. The cord is pulsing because the work of the placenta and the cord is to push that blood into the baby. Mm-hmm. And then there was this myth, this medical myth. Well, if you leave nature to do its work, the baby will be jaundiced. Really? What? I mean, whoever imagined that. That the divine creator was so inept,
seriously.
You know, I just can't believe it. So, you know, I started saying, what if we just wait? What if we just wait? Mm-hmm. And we started waiting and we started really observing. And all the midwives at Bumi Sehat, because it's in their lantars, you know, that it shouldn't be disturbed. So for them, culturally, it was like, well, they were trained to immediately clamp or cut or something would happen to the baby. I mean, wow. I've heard a doctor instructing a group of midwives in the classroom say, if you don't clamp and cut immediately, the baby will die.
Oh, my gosh. Really?
Well, that just never, ever, ever happens. So we started waiting and we started observing and at, you know, because again, you're trying to protect the first embrace. You clamp and cut the cord. The minute the mother sees the scissors, her oxytocin levels drop because she goes into fight or flight because she sees a weapon, yeah. A metal weapon. It actually says that for the first 42 days of life in the Bali Lantars, you are not supposed to put any knife or scissors or medical instrument, any metal near the baby. You don't cut their fingernails. Remember, in those days, there were no antibiotics when you know, the ancient peoples, if they used a knife, which they also used to chop up chickens and move manure in the garden, that would their big bolo knife might be their one tool in their family. And if they used that to cut the cord, they were going to have tetanus.
Wow.
And tetanus is fatal. So we had to stop that. So the wise people in ancient times said no to that. Just leave it alone. And that worked fine for, you know, human beings are an incredibly successful species. You know, we survived on this planet and we thrived. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, the new kids on the block, but
I think
200
they know
years
better.
Ago, modern sure. medicine. And all of a sudden we had men attending women at birth instead of women attending women. Mm-hmm. And then they made it, you know, we started burning witches. And that, you know, burning witches was a really good way to get rid of the competition in terms of childbirth, who was going to receive the babies into the world for profit. And so, you know, it got to the point where if your neighbor lady made a casserole for the new mother, she could be burned at the stake because she must be a witch. Mm-hmm. What did she put in that casserole? So, but the delaying of the clamping and cutting of the babies in umbilical cord, it's a human right for the baby to have their full blood supply.
In fact, you know, held up in the talk that I saw you talk about this, you literally hold up looked like a large bottle of water, I'm assuming it wasn't real blood, but, you know, saying this is how much blood that the baby, or I think maybe 60% of it, or I don't remember the percentages, that the baby wasn't 60%. Getting. And I could not help but notice that in all the videos, and there's tons of them out on your websites of brand new newborn babies, that how alert they seem and their eyes are open and they're, you know, so you think that does have to do with having that extra, you know, enriched blood still coming to them? And for how long now do you typically hold off before you do clamp and cut? Or is there a set time?
That depends on if you're talking to the Department of Health. it's become regulation now. We changed. There's 26 years of arguing about a document that was actually produced by JAPIGO. And it became all over Asia. The Departments of Health thought that was their document. But if you look on the front page, this was a midwifery manual that was generated by JAPIGO. When USAID gives Indonesia or the Philippines or India $600,000 or $1 million, that money hardly ever trickles down to the human beings and the people in the villages that need that help. Mm-hmm. What happens is USAID assigns money to Indonesia and gives it all to JAPIGO, the John Hopkins corporate arm, right? Mm-hmm. And they come up with a book. They write a book and have it translated that has nothing to do with what's culturally appropriate or what works in a country where newborn anemia can be fatal. you know, a child struggling for their entire childhood to catch up because they lost a third of their God-given blood supply at the time of birth. So we finally had one word changed, and that was the word sagra, which means immediate cord clamping and cutting, or it got changed to ditunda, which means delayed or deferred. And I was so jubilant when that word got changed in that manual. But I mean, I would talk to the TIGO office in Jakarta, and they would say to me, well, yeah, we know that delayed cord clamping and cutting is correct. And even World Health Organization says so, but it would cost, I don't know, like $160,000 or more just to begin to make that change on the level of printing new books and then socializing that with all the midwives and doctors. And I was like, you know, or what they were saying, 1.6 million to do that nationally here. And I said, well, you know, each baby's life to me is worth at least 1.6 million. And you're talking about, you know, thousands and thousands of babies every day who are being dumbed down, who are not going to have their full optimal life from the get-go. Mm-hmm. And they will have to spend a lifetime catching up. You know I was born in a military hospital. I think, gosh, what if I had delayed cord clamping and cutting? What if I wasn't taken from my mother? What if my beautiful, amazing Filipino mother wasn't told that, no, in America, you're not allowed to breastfeed. We don't do that here. It'll be an embarrassment to your husband. So she was given injections to dry her up.
Oh,
you know, these are the kinds of what I call obstetrical violence that have happened generation after generation to human beings. And we're bringing it back. There's something called the International Childbirth Initiative, which FIGO, which is Federation International Gynecologists and Obstetricians, has adapted as their vision statement.
Really?
And it's, you should Google it, International Childbirth Initiative. It's so amazing. And that is that's the revolution that we have been working towards. Midwives all over the world in every corner of the earth and birth keepers, and then getting doulas on board so that the mothers have continuous care and making sure their partners can be with them. And their partners might not be a husband. You know, sometimes there's two moms, and to make sure that that's okay too in the birth rooms. Mm-hmm. And so International Childbirth Initiative is something you should Google. You should get Deborah Pascali-Bonaro on here to talk. She's
Deborah
amazing.
Pascali-Bonaro. Yeah. Okay. Write that down.
She's Donna, the most amazing doula. And she's been that bridge between the women and the obstetricians and the gynecologists. And what we always say, it's a revolution with a small R and a big E. You know,
nice.
And the evolution, the revolution of evolution. And so it's now been ratified by FIGO, which means, for example, ACOG is part of FIGO, American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and POGI, which is here in Indonesia, our gynecologists and obstetricians organization, and they are all under the umbrella of FIGO. So sooner or later, this will be implemented, and women can begin to expect that their human rights will be protected and the human rights of their baby to have the full blood supply. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we want
That's
babies
awesome.
To be alert. We want them to breastfeed. You know, we have 100% breastfeeding rate at Bumisehat, and we believe it's because the mothers from the get-go, from the first time that we meet them, whether they come for prenatal care in the first trimester or they come only when they're in labor, from the moment that we meet them, we're giving them respect and love. It's more difficult now with COVID because we can't have our receptionist can't step out and hug them when they arrive in labor. That's just not okay, but we can namaste them and we can smile with our eyes because everybody's full of PPE. We're all covered up. But it's getting better.
One of the things that, that you said in your tech talk on the topic of breastfeeding was that, and I quote, "No one has figured out how to make money on breast milk. And so babies die for business." Wow, that's a powerful statement. And you went on to quote statistics, I believe, of literally the increased mortality rates of kids that are fed formula versus milk, mother's milk in the first year. What is that? Do you know off the top of your head?
Oh, gosh. Let's see. I haven't looked at those statistics for a while.
I won't hold you to it, but...
World Breastfeeding Alliance... has said that over 300,000 recorded deaths of babies in Indonesia per year. Those are babies that are born healthy, and that infant formula is introduced in the hospitals because the hospitals get paid for every baby they give a bottle to. And so breastfeeding gets sabotaged. The mother's got a baby who hasn't been put to the breast, or she tries to put the baby to the breast, but the baby's now sucked on a bottle, an artificial teat. And that artificial teat, the milk just runs down your throat and it's really easy. Then you go to the breast and you have nipple confusion. And a smart baby, you know, when the mothers come to us and they say, oh my gosh, my baby just won't breastfeed, we move them right into a room in Bumiseha, where no matter where that baby's been born, and we help them. Mm-hmm. And that means that we work with them throughout the day and night. It usually takes about 24 hours. But we also point out that your baby's really smart, because your baby's figured out that that artificial teat is so much easier to suck on. Yeah. And so once we get them on the breast, of course, they like the breast better. But it's a big effort once the baby has been sabotaged with infant formula. And infant formula is just, it's just so vastly different than the milk that mothers make for baby humans. You know, we have
there's no
infant
way
formula
we
has
could
cow's milk in
ever
it.
Never replicate that. Yeah.
You cannot. And the research is there. And then you can add, you know, soybeans, which are GMO. You can add soy milk to that, and it's crazy. And when a mother goes back to the village, if she's had her baby in the hospital and the baby's been introduced to infant formula and is addicted to the infant formula now, when she goes back to her village, it costs more than her husband's salary to buy that infant formula for one baby.
Oh my God.
So not only does the baby not get enough because they water it down, they have to.
Sure.
But the other children don't get enough food because the family now has nothing.
Yeah, they're paying for that formula. That's wow.
Yep.
That's
then the husband will sell his motorcycle, you know, which is their only transportation. Mm-hmm. He'll sell his motorcycle cheap to keep feeding the baby. And we have an adopted daughter, Eliana. She's 14 now. And when we got her, she was about 8 months old. And her mother was really very, very malnourished. And she was the ninth child. They were from Sumba. And they dropped her off because she was dying of starvation.
Wow.
And so my husband had to go to the store and buy infant formula. Do you know that all over this country and in most parts of the world, I know I've seen it in the Philippines, the infant formula is locked behind glass cabinets.
What? Because it's that
Yeah, and
valuable?
Locked. Because if your baby is starving, you can't even steal it.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
You can't even steal it. So my husband would be there to buy infant formula for our adopted daughter. And he'd come home and I'd say, where's the rest of the stuff on the grocery list? And he'd say, well, there were three dads there pacing in front of the infant formula cabinet. He goes, so I just spent all our money buying infant formula for them because they couldn't feed their babies. So, and I said, wow, did you tell them about Bumiseha? And he said, yeah. I mean, these were babies that were already, you know, the mothers had dried up. There was no possibility they'd breastfeed. But he would give these people Bumiseha stickers. He kept them in his wallet. And he'd say, next baby, come to Bumiseha and you'll be and guaranteed you're be able to have a breastfeeding baby and a breastfeeding mother. And so the husbands would put those stickers on their motorcycles. Now the police don't get a big salary here, so a lot of them come to Bumiseha, most of them in fact, the police in our area, to have their babies. And so if you get pulled over and you have a Bumiseha sticker on your motorbike, you'll just be let go. They're like, we had a baby at Bumiseha too. You're a Bumiseha dad. Go for it.
You're
love
in the
you.
Club. You're in the club.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of your work that you have done after a disaster and the impact that that has on reproductive health? Can you talk a little bit about that? I remember in one of your talks you mentioned that even though buildings fall down and roads are shut down, babies are still going to come into this world. And so, you know, they're not going to wait for anything. And that's where you guys step in and help, which I think is amazing.
It started with the tsunami. And when the tsunami happened here in Indonesia, we were hearing day by day, hour by hour, the news was like, oh my goodness, it could be 1,000 people died. It could be 10,000 people died. You know, in the end, the military guys that we worked with when we arrived there told me that in Indonesia, I mean, it says online that it's somewhere around 230 to 260,000 people died that day. The military told me that they actually disposed of over 400,000 human remains.
You're kidding.
In Aceh. So, and then that doesn't account Sri Lanka, India, all over the world. You know, it's the whole Indian Ocean, everyone was affected. And that was our first disaster. We got there 3 weeks before the Red Cross. Because we were right in Indonesia, we didn't have to wait for permits. You know, we packed up those big plastic boxes that you can seal, and then we sealed them with tape. And we, you know, got down to the airport, and we guilt tripped the airline into giving us unlimited luggage. And we brought an amazing group of Balinese guys, the Roustabouts from Walhi, which is Friends of the Earth, awesome. Who went and set up our camp. And we've been called by Direct Relief International to disasters ever since, because when a mother becomes homeless, when she doesn't have potable water, when she doesn't have proper food, and she's pregnant, she is still going to have that baby. Mm-hmm. And she needs a safe, hygienic, kind place to have that baby. So we've had incredible stories from those disaster zones. And
if I'm not mistaken, I believe I read that there in Aceh, you now have a partnership in place that I read that you were arming the grandmothers there with free cell phones and providing, you know, midwives, and every single birth was having a, you know, somebody from your organization, and this whole new partnership that is saving lives, which is amazing.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, we were, you know, because they didn't have hand phones and they didn't have electricity. So we got hand phones and little cranks that you can crank charge them. Mm-hmm. And we buy their hand phone plans for them. And they have like little parties every month where they come together. They bring all the pregnant women from their area so that they get prenatal care. They get the free vitamins. We have an incredible partnership with Blackmores for free vitamins. And I mean, the quality of those vitamins is incredible. And of course, people say, well, why don't you just feed people better? But again, with poverty, you know, we know the vitamins aren't fully sustainable, but it's like a starfish. You got to throw that starfish back in the ocean.
Yep.
And yeah, the army of traditional birth attendants, the Dukun Bayi, has been incredible. And some of them were incredibly old when we trained them. Have you ever taught an 89-year-old woman how to use a hand phone?
Yes, as a matter of fact. Well, maybe not 89. My mom is 83, and I've had some fun trying to get her. Well, maybe a smartphone. Of course, I guess that's a little more complex. But
yeah, well, these are just little
challenge.
$20 Nokias, but yeah, and it's been an incredibly beautiful, beautiful initiative that saved lives. We're so proud of it.
That's awesome. Well, I know we're running a little on time, so I had a few of I printed out a few of your quotes here that are on your website.
I have to be careful what I say.
You better, because it's going to come back to you. But I loved some of these. And I wanted to read them out, a few of these, and feel free to interrupt with any of your thoughts here. One is, quote, "Women will always pay the price for love. That is why God makes us so much stronger than men." I like that one.
I love that.
I think I learned that from my mother.
Yes. Well, I certainly don't think you learned it from a man, but nonetheless, I love it. The next one, "I became a fierce advocate for gentle birth as a solution for the most pressing problems of our times, a solution that begins at the source, birth." I think that's beautiful.
Yeah. I do believe that each and every individual is a piece of peace. And so if we think about, you know, it's societies that make war, but those societies are made up of individuals that come from families. So if we start to heal people on the level of making sure that they have their optimal love, their optimal experience at the time, at that fulcrum of birth when they're arriving on Earth, we try to really delete the trauma from their experience. Those individuals are going to grow up to be stewards of our planet. And that's what we need.
That's...
You know, our planet doesn't have another generation to wait. You know, that's why I've devoted my life to this, and my family's devoted their lives.
That brings up a couple more of my quotes here, as a matter of fact. Every baby's first breath on earth could be one of peace and love. Every mother should be healthy and strong. Every birth could be safe and loving. But our world is not there yet.
Well, I heard Kamala Harris say today on Democracy Now! When we were listening. That's my daughter. Hold on.
No worries.
Hi, sweetie. I'm on an interview. Can I call you back? Oh, I love you. I'll call you. I guess you're going to bed. I'll call you tomorrow. I love you so much. I love you. Bye. Okay. I love you. Bye.
That was awesome.
But Kamala said she believes in humanity. And I feel the same way. I feel like we have so much creative intelligence, you know, and I find that, for example, mothers in labor, if one person believes in them, one person, mm-hmm. it makes all the difference.
Amen. Here's another one. I came to the conclusion that bringing humans to Earth with an intact ability to love is essential if we are to survive as a species. Really? Yeah. You think it's that important to our survival as a species?
The climate crisis is an extinction level event.
Sure.
We're facing extinction, and we owe it to, you know, we owe it to you, Aaron, to give you and your children and your grandchildren a home.
Yeah.
You know, you need a home to live on. My children, my grandchildren, they need a home. And I feel like if we don't start with respect and honoring and loving each individual, how can we expect them to make peace? How can we expect them to respect the Mother Earth? I believe that the relationship with mother is the mother that whose body you came from is relates to your respect for the Earth Mother. I feel like
Absolutely.
They're so connected. And so as we, you know, I remember growing up and thinking, gosh, all of my friends hate their parents. Well, you know, I didn't feel that way.
Nor did I. Yeah, but I agree. In American society, here anyway, it's so, yeah, it's not cool to be around your parents. And I never got it either.
And if you don't respect your own mother, how can you respect your Earth Mother?
Sure.
Yeah.
But we're reinventing our culture. I feel like the American part of me is excited about this reinvention and frightened about what's going on. And politically
As
and environmentally
we. As are we
there.
Well, we're hoping, Robin, in the next 3 weeks we'll go and make a change in the right direction towards acknowledging that climate change is occurring, that we'll go back to believing what the science is telling us about how we're harming our planet. That's what we're hoping for, so we'll see.
Definitely.
I have two more quotes. The babies have taught me the world is worth saving. I love that too. And my favorite one that I found somewhere else, actually, you just kind of said it, you know, just kind of off the cuff in one of the videos that I watched. And you said, quote, I found that my life purpose really is love. If I wasn't living for love every minute of every day, what's the point? Ibu Robin, thank you so much. You have changed my whole outlook about childbirth. I think I've looked at it as a typical white dude that, you know, take your kid to the hospital. And don't get me wrong, the three greatest days of my life were the birth of my children. And I was in the room there with them the moment they were born. And we were lucky that all three of our kids were natural births. And that's why Erin is so intelligent and beautiful and amazing. She had that love.
Thank you.
And our kids were breastfed. And so we, you know, but I will acknowledge I took for granted the care that my family had. And so I wanted to do my part to shout out to the world your story. And so we are certainly going to do our part. For all of our listeners out there, once again, please go to bumisehat.org. That's BUMISEHAT.org. And you can find a lot more amazing information about Ibu Robin at iburobin.com. That's IBURobin.com, which, by the way, I don't think we mentioned. Tell our listeners what Ibu means. Robin, please.
Ibu means mother.
And
it means mother.
She is arguably the most amazing mother on the planet. It has been an absolute pleasure meeting you, chatting with you. I would love to do this again in 6 months or a year to get another update, to keep singing out what you guys are doing. One of these days,
yes.
I'd love to get on a plane and come see you face to face as well. So don't be surprised if I...
I look forward to that. Make sure you're coming, Erin.
That would be
Erin
awesome.
Will come with me. Maybe even when she's about 9 months pregnant. How about it, Erin? But Erin, don't be in any big hurry for that.
Not anytime soon.
Exactly.
Take your time.
There you go. Thank you again, Ibu
Robin.
Well,
thank you so much.
Have a wonderful
day. I love you. Thank you.
Love you back.
Love you too. Thanks for chatting with us.
Have a great rest of the day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Special thanks to our guest, Ibu Robin Lim, and thanks to Robin's husband, Will Hammer, for the wonderful song, Thank You for Mine, featured in today's show. Stick around after these credits to hear the entire song, along with a compilation of some of Robin's inspirational comments from the podcast. Thanks to our producer, Noah Existe, and editor, Joe Tampoco. Our music was written and performed by Nadia Importante. Thank you so much for listening. If this podcast brightened your day in any way, please subscribe and leave us a comment. And in case no one's told you this today, you make this world a better place. Spread that love and give a smile to a stranger.
Make the world a better place. Make the world a better place. Make the world a better place. Make the world a better place.
We're facing extinction, and we owe it to, you know, we owe it to you, Erin, to give you and your children and your grandchildren a home. You know, you need a home to live on. My children, my grandchildren, they need a home. And I feel like if we don't start with respect and honoring and loving each individual, how can we expect them to make peace? How can we expect them to respect the Mother Earth? I believe that the relationship with mother is the mother that whose body you came from is relates to your respect for the Earth Mother. But we're reinventing our culture. I feel like the American part of me is excited about this reinvention and frightened about what's going on in politically and environmentally. Second season, women started to hemorrhage to death following childbirth. These are not old people dying who have health issues. These are people in the prime of their lives. If two 747 planes fell out of the sky every single day, nobody would fly. People would be asking some questions, but that number of women die every day. And those women are women of color often, or women who are marginalized for some reason, they're malnourished, you know? And when we change the staple food of such a large population of the world, we really endangered women. And what happens to a family when a young woman dies having a baby? We really have to think about changing the staple food of entire countries and how. You know, it was something that was well-intended, and it was a disaster. And anyway, we can go back to whoever thought of spraying poison all over the food of human beings. Who do you practice on? You go out to way to the eastern part of Indonesia, where the Austroasians live, the black people. Because black lives don't matter. It's really sad. And, you know, here she is with her beautiful hair and her dark skin, and she walked into the hospital, and they held her down and knocked her out and cut her. all because Raquel decided that, you know what, the human rights of myself and my baby are really important. I'm going to find my way to this birth center that I heard a rumor was going to be kind and loving, and I would have skilled midwives, and I would respect. No other species of mammal interferes with the bonding between mother and child. No other species of mammal pulls on the placenta to get it out. No other species cuts the cord. Wise people in ancient times said no to that. Just leave it alone. And that worked fine. For, you know, human beings are incredibly successful species. You know, we survived on this planet and we thrived. Delaying of the clamping and cutting of the baby's umbilical cord, it's a human right for the baby to have their full blood supply. And I said, well, you know, each baby's life to me is worth at least 1.6 million. And you're talking about, you know, thousands and thousands of babies every day who are being dumbed down. We're not going to have their full optimal life from the get-go. And they will have to spend a lifetime catching up. One of my beautiful, amazing Filipino mother wasn't told that no in America. We don't do that here. It'll be an embarrassment to your husband. So she was given injections to dry her up. You know, these are the kinds of what I call obstetrical violence that have happened generation after generation to human beings. So sooner or later, this will be implemented, and women can begin to expect that their human rights will be protected and the human rights of their baby to have the full blood supply. Yet we want babies to be alert. We want them to breastfeed. You know, we have 100% breastfeeding rate at Bumisehat, and we believe it's because the mothers from the get-go, from the first time that we meet them, whether they come for prenatal care in the first trimester or they come only when they're in labor, from the moment that we meet them, we're giving them respect and love. Disasters ever since. Because when a mother becomes homeless, when she doesn't have potable water, when she doesn't have proper food, and she's pregnant, she is still going to have that baby. And she needs a safe, hygienic, kind place to have that baby. I do believe that each and every individual is a piece of peace. And so if we think about, you know, it's societies that make war, but those societies are made up of individuals that come from families. So if we start to heal people on the level of making sure that they have their optimal love, their optimal experience at the time, at that fulcrum of birth when they're arriving on Earth, we try to really delete the trauma from their experience. Those individuals are going to grow up to be stewards of our planet. And that's what we need. You know, our planet doesn't have another generation to wait. You know, that's why I've devoted my life to this, and my family's devoted their lives.